Doesn't that computer know who you
are? Don't they have any idea?
Bow down to the Tech Talk host.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Behold the glory that is
me. A little while ago, I was installing some software, and I ran across this exact same thing.
I find you pompous, judgmental, and completely self-absorbed. Would you be my friend?
Onto a Windows Vista machine.
You would think.
You'd think there'd be no problem.
How could there be a problem with that?
I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Directory permissions with config.msi directory, blah, 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 blah.
This is Tech Talk. Good morning. This is Tech Talk. I got Michael Tech Talk Kessler, and I'm hoping Dave Sparky Saganaki on the other line here with us.
Can you hear me?
I can, absolutely. Wow, listen to this. We've got it's working, folks. Which is a good thing today. I'm really excited about today. This is going to be one of those shows where we perhaps stretch the definition of tech talk, but have a lot of fun doing it. We're going to have Nick Brouse on. He is a Shakespearean expert and one of the main contributors to, well, he's going to tell us about it, but it is an app that is going to help introduce kids and everybody else to a really easy to access introduction to Shakespeare and Shakespeare's plays. And he's got Hamlet is out already, and we're gonna have a blast talking. I was talking to him earlier before the show, and I think it's just going to be a tremendous amount of fun, and it's something that people should hear about, and good stuff. So we'll have that. We've got Jay coming on in a couple of minutes as well to talk about geek trivia, and then hopefully stick around with us too, because Jay's a lover of the Bard as well, and we'll do that. So, Jay, Dave, great to have you here. How did the week treat you? Did you stay up on top of all of the CES news and all the crazy stuff coming out, the 120-inch TVs from Vizio and all that great stuff, or did you find something else to take up your time?
No, I didn't follow it super closely, but it's hard to avoid it. If you follow technology news at all, there's just so much of it. This year, I think, has been the media coverage has been very, very strong this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. And I don't know if that's a indication that this is just more of kind of a thing that people are into now, or it just that they've just gotten better at kind of following it and understanding and identifying what the important stories that are coming out of it are. I mean, we're seeing a lot of stuff about smartphones, mobile phones, a lot of things about the TVs. I kind of have to take some of the TV stuff with a little bit of a grain of salt, just because I remember last year the big deal was what was it called? The four TV, or, you know, four times the HD resolution. They're talking about it still this year. We had the 3D TVs a couple years ago that really never took off. I don't know. Yeah, I've been trying to kind of avoid it just a little bit myself, but it's been tough. It's been tough.
Yeah. Well, there's been a lot of great stories, like the electric Formula One car. That's interesting. There's just been a tremendous amount of fascinating products. Did you see the little road race cars that they have that are autonomous cars?
No, I didn't
see that. Oh yeah, it's a little track and two cars. You can get a track and two cars, and it's in the $200 price range. It's not quite out yet, and you control them with an app on iOS. So far, they don't have an Android app or anything like that, and they're due out soon. But basically, you can set them to race each other, or you can speed them up, or and there's weapons, and they have virtual weapons on board that you can shoot at each other.
Oh, man.
I don't have it up in front of me. I didn't think this stuff would translate well on air. I could be wrong about that. But it's trying to describe this, but it sounds very exciting. Mm-hmm. And it's basically like slot cars without slots that you have some control over, or you can leave them to control on their own. They call the cars characters. They have styling similar to the Transformer robot type things. So if one of those were available down the street, I might be tempted to pick it up.
Yeah. Wow. That would be cool. Now I've got some friends who were really, really heavily into the whole RC racer kind of thing. You know, the remote control mm-hmm. racers. This is back, you know, from the day. Now these clubs still exist. It's really just a track, and you run these cars around the track, and you can create your own RC cars, and you run them, and all this other good stuff. People take it very seriously. This would take that to a whole new level, and especially I love the idea of having car mounted weaponry on there that you can that you can control. That's fantastic.
Yeah. That's one thing that is not robotic, as far as I know. You actually have to fire the weaponry at the other car.
Mm-hmm.
And the video of it is hysterical. Why aren't we at CES? That's what I want to know.
I keep trying to find someone to pay our ticket. Bish just he won't fork up the money for it. I don't know why. I pay my dues every year, you know, religiously, and nothing back, no love back. I tell you, just think of what we would get.
Oh man.
Oh, can you hear me? Can you hear me, Dave?
Yeah, I've got you back now.
All right. Man, I was saying there's no love there from Bish for CES. He won't send us out there. I think it would be a wonderful event for us to really establish a good connection with the technical community. But just not. They need to have CES in Chicago next year, I think, and then we there we go. Or in Toronto. One or the other.
I don't. It'd be hard to beat Vegas for that. For that context, but you know, maybe we can combine it with the next Route 66 gig.
Hey, there you go, a little road trip. You know, you come down here. Maybe we can make it farther than the Route 66 guy. I'm poking fun. The Route 66 guys went from the studio here to take the whole Route 66 trip. They unfortunately didn't make it as far as they wanted to go, but they still produced a tremendous amount of excitement and fun and had a great run and show while they did that. But I poked fun at them because. It's like maybe we can get past Springfield when we go.
Yeah, I know. I was in on the early planning stages of that, and I thought it would be good to go further, but they were coming from England and stuff. So
yeah,
and it was a great effort and a good project. So that's what we need to do next time. We combine it with CES, and then we can have technical difficulties all the way to Vegas.
Absolutely, I like it. I think that's a nice thing. That's a good thing. Hey, on other news, I did have a couple of things that I thought was really interesting. So there was a couple things that were happening. One is that Nintendo, I found this really fascinating. For some reason, just because of the sense of justice, Nintendo has been sued repeatedly, of course, for patent infringement, most recently because of their Wii Balance Board. But the patent infringement cases against them have... almost every single one of them has been thrown out of court or has clearly come from these guys that you call patent trolls. And Nintendo has stood very firm and has said, hey, we're going to fight every single last one of these. We are not going to give in. And generally, I think in every case, in fact, they've beat them. Now they're going on the offensive. Nintendo is actually going out and they're buying up these patent troll firms. They just, in fact, purchased IA Labs, and that's a company that had launched a lawsuit against Nintendo back in 2010. And I think this is fantastic. What better way to combat it? Just buy them up. Buy them up, fire everybody, and be done with it, you know?
So now are they going to sue themselves? I mean, in order to make it a viable business model, what? They're just going to buy them and let them go? And Lord knows they've got the money. We've detailed this before on Tech Talk, how huge the video game market is these days.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, I guess the idea is they're looking at companies that they know have patents or own patents that could be used by these patent trolls to, you know, cause them problems. And they're saying, hey, instead of letting them sit out there and cause us problems, we're just going to take the bull by the horns, so to speak, and put an end to it. It's sort of the, you know, sort of the similar to the legitimate purchasing of companies like Nortel that, you know, companies like Cisco and others did in order to take advantage of those patents. But those were legitimate, real patents that they wanted their hands on. These are people that own these, what I would consider illegitimate patents, patents that are so broad in their definition and applicability that they're being used by, and they're called patents. Patent trolls, that's a very common phrase. Maybe people haven't heard it, but it's a company that whose sole purpose is not to create anything, but to actually just use these very broadly worded patents that our poorly designed patent system has allowed them to obtain to make trouble for large companies in the hopes that the company will just pay them to make them go away. And some of these companies have been very, very successful at this. And then there's others that have, you know, wrangled with the big guys like Nintendo and lost, fortunately. So I'd like to see that continue. I, you know what? I should bring Jay in so we can make this go quickly. I just remembered we've got a bit of a schedule. It's been a while since we've had a schedule for this stuff here, trying to bring in... Nick in a few minutes as well.
Yeah, it'll be good to hear from Jay.
Yeah. Oh, hey, good morning, Mr. Garmin.
Yeah.
How you doing, sir? Flying solo today, I hear. So we'll...
Yeah, the wife had to work today, so I'm a single dad right now.
Oh man, well, you know, that's all right though. That's all right. You get a little bit of one-on-one time with the kids. Never a bad. Well, not usually a bad thing.
Not always a bad thing.
Exactly. We have our days. Actually, in fact, I'm laughing. My son is here in the studio with me today. I don't know if we're going to have time to do our Kids Talk Tech at the end of the show, but he was interested actually in hearing. We're going to have, as you know, Jay, I mentioned earlier, we're going to have Nick Brouse on from First Folio, Hamlet2014.com, and have him on talking about their app and the introducing Shakespeare to kids and into the educational system. So that should be fun. And hopefully you can stick around with us for that as well. In order to get there, though, we should probably make sure we get the necessaries out of the way and respond to last week's Tech Talk geek trivia question. Gosh darn it, I don't have it up in front of me. I apologize. What were you asking us about last week?
Well, since CES is all about wearable computing, was last week since it was going on, the question was, what was the first wearable computer to include a microprocessor?
Oh, that's
right. And the reason I ask it that way is that you could technically argue that, like, the old abacus necklaces from, you know, ancient China were wearable computers. They were just analog. or, you know, any wristwatch is a wearable computer. But, like, when we think about computers, you think about something with an actual processor that you could possibly, you know, do some real serious computation in. And the first wearable computing device to include an actual microprocessor was something... created by the eudaimonic industries, which was a group of a couple of chaos theory mathematicians who wanted to prove that you could beat the casino. So they built a set of shoes, believe it or not, with a off-the-shelf CMOS 6502 microprocessor and 5K of RAM, and a switch in the toe of these platform shoes that they could tap in instructions to the computer based on where the ball was and how fast they noticed it going from one number to the next, and it would predict which octant of the wheel the roulette ball would stop, and they could influence their betting, and it would increase their odds of success. And it was connected by radio to an earpiece and so on and so forth. And apparently they got away with it because the casino never stopped them until they published a book about it.
Mm-hmm. Which the book, by the way, is fantastic. It's called Eudaimonic Pie, and it's spelled P-I-E, not P-I. And it's It's awesome. The story is truly fascinating. You know, we've only touched on the high points of it. It really is a neat thing, and it's right at that introduction and cusp of the, you know, transistor age and the computing age.
They built this in 1978.
Wow!
And what's funny is they were not the first people to do this. In the 60s, people built exactly the same devices, either in shoes or in a cigarette pack, but they were mechanical analog computers where they would tap in instructions and it would send out a series of basically Morse code beats back to a radio listener who would analyze the results, and then through a faked up hearing aid would send instructions back to the people at the table betting. So they had analog computers doing this in the 60s, but in the late 70s, guys named Packard, and I'm trying to think of the other guy's name that did this, a couple of chaos mathematicians, Farmer, Packard and Farmer, a couple of innocent-sounding guys who are both still world-renowned experts in chaos theory, said, we can do better than these crappy analog computers in the 60s, and they built one out of an off-the-shelf microprocessor and actually built what we would consider a computer into a set of platform shoes.
And what's fun too is and the book goes into detail on this is their team. So their team was made up not only of these high level mathematicians and just incredibly brilliant people, but you also had a couple of rugby players on there. Because they were the only guys that had the physical coordination to be able to accurately tap out the timing of that ball swinging past close enough that they could use the computer to approximate that octet of the board. And then the other fun thing that was happening frequently, and the reason why they didn't like take Vegas down was or Reno down, was because the hardware, the electronics in their shoes would malfunction badly enough to the point that they had to run to the bathroom and put their foot in the toilet before they burst into flame. Things like that. Like I said, it did not even occur to me when you brought up this question, Jay, but this is one of my, this is really one of the things that I love. And I can't recommend enough the Eudaimonic Pi book to go out and read more about this story for people, because it is absolutely fantastic. So what should we be thinking about for next week? It's going to be tough to top that, but what should we be thinking about for next week?
Well, the holiday computer breach of Target discount store's credit card processing keeps metastasizing into a worse and worse story. They keep upping the number of records they think might have been breached. And by they, I mean security experts, and Target admits to different things in that. And some people talk about this may be the worst credit card breach ever. Well, it's not gotten there, but the reason why you can make that argument is every time there's a credit card breach, there's two different figures released. There's the breach the company admits to, which is always lower than the truth. And then there's the breach that some third-party security expert estimates based on what they know of the situation, which is always way high, because security experts always want you to tell you the world is ending, because then you need their services. This is near and dear to my heart, consulting with Backupify, because it's only hard to find reliable data. The number that really matters is, when all is said and done, how much money does the person breached settle with for anyone else who's harmed by their lack of security? So the question is, what is the largest financial settlement in history for the hacking of credit card data?
Oh, that's a great question, man. Oh, man. Yeah. Who really got put on the hook for credit card data? Wow. I
will say that there are a wild number of figures about how many records were breached in this particular event. But based on the sort of generally accepted number, the company involved does not cop to this number. They never will. And in the settlement, they will never agree to how many records were breached. But there's a generally accepted figure, and it's in the eight-figure range.
Wow.
Of records breached.
Wow.
So Target right now, the high level of Target is 70 million.
Yep.
So we're talking another zero beyond that in terms of breach for the all-time financial record holder. Now, Target may end up paying more in actual dollars than this, even for possibly fewer records breached, just because, you know, they may just want to pay to make this go away, and we'll pay any amount of money to make it stop.
Yeah, well, and especially
it's getting really bad.
Especially if you consider the non-direct payments that they've made already, such as offering a 10% discount to everybody with a Target card that weekend after, you know, things like this that are probably going to continue going on. I just read recently too that Neiman Marcus was just hacked, and I didn't get too deep into the article. It was just today that I heard about it. Same type of situation and all that. Now, I used to work for Target this is way back in the day as a summer job and all this. But you know, it's man.
Well, that explains the breach.
I had nothing to do with their computer. All that I had to do with their computer systems was so this is so far back in the day. There were no, we called them zip zap machines when they were first coming through, the zip zap machines, you know, with the lasers that would read your barcodes. No. We had to stand there, and as each item came up, you had to type the SKU into the keypad that would then run through the system and pull up the correct price and all this. And so I was one of the top cashiers because I was extremely fast on my 10 key punch. So there you go.
Who knew that many people went to Target? You know, in reading about this, people's reports. What should we do? What as a consumer? What they're actually, you know, I've heard it hasn't happened to me, but in some cases. A clerk will ask for your driver's license, and they'll scan your driver's license either when you're checking into a hotel or even at a retail outlet, mm-hmm. And they'll then have that in their system. What's the safest thing to do? Just pay cash?
Well, there are actually a number of things that you can do, you know, depending on how concerned you are about stuff like that. If you're purchasing online, there's actually a number of services that will allow you to create single use credit card numbers, and you can do things like that. You know, PayPal is theoretically one of the more secure ways to also purchase online, things like this. When you're in person and you're using just a standard credit card, you know, there's so many ways for people to take that number and reuse it. It's different. And like you say, in most of the ways that we have to make it more secure actually expose you to greater risk, taking your license and recording that, you know, doing anything along those lines. I think eventually, and this is why we're going to start seeing more and more of these new technologies, and I can't off the top of my head think of the name of this newest one that's come out that allows you to do all of your credit cards through a single piece of hardware. That your phone,
the coin,
that's it. Yes, and your phone controls this. They have a variation of it that you would actually have a thumbprint reader on it before it could be activated. You know, those types of things, and keeping that centralized in that way. I think eventually that's where we're gonna have to end up. But that's gonna have its own risk.
Google Wallet will issue you a similar card that processes through your wallet account, so all the linked accounts and wallet go through that, but they charge you a transaction fee, and I forget what it is, like 2.9%, so you're paying the additional fee. In answer to Dave's question, I've been with companies that have looked into this, the general answer is use credit, not debit. Even if you have a debit card, use it as, if it's got that option, it's got Visa or MasterCard, use it as the credit option, and the general reason for that is by according to financial regulation and federal law, the credit card company bears the burden of proof. So if your account is hacked or a fraudulent charge is on there, you are not liable for it. The credit card company is liable for it. So it's in their interest to prevent fraud. That's why you get those friendly phone calls of, hey, have you been in China recently buying livestock? Because there was a charge on your card and we didn't put it through.
Exactly.
Because they're liable for it. On the flip side, in some cases, the debit card, it's just like writing a check. You know, sometimes, depending on state law and other regulations, the debit card, you know, if they get that and they get your PIN number, it's sort of on you and the bank to work that out. And most banks want to keep your business, so they tend to be okay with it, but it's not always certain that you're just not going to get hosed. But stores, incidentally, incentivize you to use debit cards because debit cards have much lower transaction fees for the store than credit cards. So they keep more of your money when you use debit. So the store wants you to use debit, but debit is higher risk.
Yeah. Yeah, higher risk to the consumer.
Cards.
Yep. Yep. Hey, I want to bring Nick Browse in right now. I'm going to give him a ring to his phone and see if we can get him joining us, and hopefully everybody can hear everybody else as well. I'm going to put him on the other computer. Can you hear that ring?
Indeed.
I can hear the ring.
Fantastic.
I can hear the ring. I've been getting some dropouts, so if I'm quiet for a while, that's the reason.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Hopefully.
Good morning, Nick Browse.
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Browse. Welcome to the show. Can you hear us, sir? Hello? All right. Well, and apologies. I hope, Nick, you're listening. We are going to bring you in here in just a minute. I'm going to do it a little bit differently here. We're going to do a couple of legal IDs and spots and all sorts of good stuff. We will be right back in at you, though. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Tech Talk on WRLR 98.3 LPFM.
You're listening to 98.3 FM, WRLR LP, Round Lake Heights, Illinois.
The law firm of McGee, Nagley, and Associates is located in Round Lake and provides legal services for Round Lake, Lake County, and surrounding areas. Their attorneys advise clients in the areas of bankruptcy, foreclosure defense, real estate law, litigation, and general practice matters. The law firm of McGee, Nagley, and Associates is located at 444 North Cedar Lake Road in Round Lake. Their website is www.mcgeenagley.com. Their phone number is 847-546-0055.
All right, and we're trying Mr. Browse again and see if we can make this happen.
Nick Browse.
Hey, good morning, Nick. I apologize for the technical foul up there. We apparently couldn't hear each other. Good morning, Nick. Welcome to the Tech Talk Show. Really excited to have you with us. Unfortunately, I because of the technical issue, I was forced to drop some of the other people that we had on here out. I'm going to try to bring one person back in with us. But, Nick, while I'm doing that, you may hear some ringing in the background. Why don't you tell us a little bit about why you're here to join us and what's up with Hamlet First Folio, Hamlet2014.com, and all this great stuff that you got going on.
Okay, well, thank you, Mike. So we've developed a new web application. It's a digital textbook of Shakespeare's Hamlet. It's the first in a series of digital textbooks that we're developing for schools, for our high school and university students studying the play, to really bring Hamlet and bring Shakespeare into the digital age. It's not unlike the digital textbooks from that exist currently. It's not just a PDF of a printed book, but it's a web application with the full text of the play, with commentaries, with audio content. That's going to be video content that students can download from their or can work with from their iPhones, from their iPads, or from any laptop or desktop computer.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, and you were kind enough to give me an opportunity to play with it and to experiment with it. And I have a great fascination with Shakespeare. I have a bit of a liberal arts background myself, and so it was a lot of fun to get in and use it. And the difference between this and reading just a straight text, like the text of Hamlet, is, of course, you guys are leveraging all of the easy connectivity that you have with electronic information, analyses of words, insight into what the phrasing and the phraseology means and some of this other things that are happening. Is that something? I mean, I know that was something you were focused on. How easy was it to translate from that text into the electronic realm?
First off, Shakespeare's English is actually much, much closer to modern English than, quote unquote, the English, modern English that we speak today than most people realized. So what What exists basically is sort of, you know, analyses and definitions of unfamiliar words and terms. That information is basically in pretty much every published edition of Hamlet in the form of footnotes or appendices in the back of the book, or so how often have you had to read a Shakespeare text and then, oh, wait a second, there's a footnote. I have to go down to the bottom of the page, look at the footnote to know what that word means. Mm-hmm. With this digital technology, we can actually show you the definition of that unfamiliar word or have an analysis of that particular passage right there. You just click on the icon and it's right there next to the text. So you don't disrupt the flow of the read, basically.
Yep. Yep, and that's my personal experience with Shakespeare was literally sitting there with two books, having the play itself in front of me, and then next to me a larger, compendium of Shakespeare's literature, English, and analyses, and this really combines the two together. This is designed though, really for a younger audience though, really is where you're kind of directing things at the moment. Is that correct? Like the K-12 set?
I would say directed mostly to the high school and university level students. I mean, it's certainly any student of Shakespeare, like I'm a student of Shakespeare myself, any student of Shakespeare could, appreciate the app and certainly use it. But it is geared toward high school and university students who are studying the play. Because let's face it, you had to learn Shakespeare in school, I had to learn Shakespeare in school, I think pretty much across the country and, practically around the world. I mean, high school and university students have to, on some level, read Shakespeare, understand Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. And that's very important today. And I think one of the reasons that it is important to, read Hamlet today, for example, is his, immense vocabulary. I mean, a lot of the unfamiliar words that will seem unfamiliar to us actually show up on the SATs.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, and that is such an interesting thing. And I'm a big lover of language just in general too. So that crossover with Shakespeare is fascinating to me. I know that's one of the reasons why there's a debate over whether or not the plays were written by a single individual, is that most texts that are written by a person use between 7,000 to 10,000 or so individual unique words, whereas the plays of Shakespeare encapsulate something like 30,000 unique words, of which 7,000 or so are ones completely made up by him.
that's absolutely right. But I think one of the things we have to remember, to your point, a couple things. First of all, I do believe that Shakespeare was Shakespeare. William Shakespeare did write the works that were credited to him. But we have to remember that theater, like movies today, and theater today, it's a collaborative medium.
Mm-hmm.
So the plays weren't like, it wasn't something that Shakespeare sat down in his study and just wrote, and then all of a sudden, well, here it is. No, they were living, breathing documents that he would have had input from his fellow producers and the actors, and the actors might read the line one way and he might change it based on how they read it, and theater was a very collaborative sort of process. So to say that it's all the work of one, of one man is like, well, no play and no movie is the work of one person.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one of the things I think too that I really like with the Hamlet2014.com, the app, is that not only do you get the definitions and the analyses in the context of the text itself, but then there's also a lot of kind of ex libris sort of things that you do with comparing quartos and defining what a bad quarto is and why that was important to us, and putting it in historical context of how Hamlet was created and how Shakespeare was working to create this literature and what sort of things were going on with him quite frankly I had no exposure to when I was studying Shakespeare myself. A lot of this was very new to me.
That's interesting, and it's something that I think is it may be new to a lot of people, and maybe things that have sort of been forgotten. But in the spirit of the Renaissance, for trying to be reborn, if you will, if you pardon the pun. I think what's interesting about Shakespeare's time and sort of, I think, what enabled Shakespeare to be Shakespeare is and give to us the immense body of work that he left for us today is not just the fact that he was a genius, but the specific time period in which he lived in. I mean, he lived in a time, his generation was the first generation to see theater since before the fall of Rome.
I want to point out
today, we're dealing with the internet today, and the internet has changed the way we communicate with each other. Mm-hmm. Shakespeare was going through, that was basically theater was changing the way people communicate with each other in Shakespeare's time.
Yep. Yeah, and in fact, there's an awesome little tidbit that there was actually when the generation that William Shakespeare was born into was the generation that there was created the theater with, you know, a capital T, because it was the one theater that existed in the world.
I love it that you knew that. Thank you. Yes, absolutely. You're absolutely right. That is very true.
That just blew me away. And again, you know, putting that into the context, the importance of the time that he was born into, which raises that big, you know, the big hairy question is, so 500 years ago, 600 years ago, we have this text, this document, these plays, these sonnets, all of these things. Why is that, other than the language, you know, which has been incorporated in, why are the themes important? Why is Shakespeare as text important to us to read now and for high school kids? Why are they still bothering with this guy from 600 years ago?
Well, it's the same reason we bother with theater today and movies, and I believe the movies are an evolution of theater. It's Shakespeare really didn't invent anything. He took what he took from, you know, from the Greeks and from stories that had been written, you know, before him. He just happened to do it better than anybody else. And the merit of his work is just it's better than what had been done before, and it's, quite frankly, we mimic him today because we can't. we really just quite can't get as good as he, you know, as he was, and good not just from the merit of his work, but also the volume of work. The complete works of William Shakespeare captures every single, you know, human impulse, human nature that really. I mean, I challenge people to actually say, okay, well, find something in human nature that's not covered in Shakespeare. you know, you'd be hard-pressed to.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, one thing that's interesting about the English school system that I learned from a colleague of mine in the UK is that in England, you cannot enter college until you have read the complete canon. All 37 plays, five or six of the poems and all the sonnets.
Mm.
That is like, you cannot enter college until you've read everything he wrote.
That's, you know, and the thing is, so you mentioned like these themes, these human themes, and that's one question that comes up. You know, I mentioned to you before we got on the air, I managed IT for school districts here in Illinois. One of the big concerns in the school districts was exposure to inappropriate themes over the internet. Now, Shakespeare, we don't normally would say, oh, well, that's inappropriate, but if you've read it, there's just these really frank and joyful descriptions of sex acts, of... from onanism to the biracial relationships in Othello, which was way beyond its time. And you think about the 40s and 50s when these plays were being performed then in America. But you've got cuckolding, murder. It goes on and on and on. As you said, every good and bad thing that humanity seems to be capable of. How do we balance that? How does that work for us that we want to, protect some, innocent ears, but at the same time expose them to this wonderful aspect of literature and humanity?
Well, you know, perhaps it is, you know, when students, let's say Hamlet, for example, students, high school students are exposed to Hamlet usually around the 11th or 12th grade, you know, junior, senior year. And, you know, quite frankly, it's really, you know, that by that time, in that age, you know, perhaps it is appropriate to have, you know, students or young people know what these things are. Because a tragedy, the reason that we look at the tragedies and the reason, oh, everybody dies in the end, oh my God, isn't that horrible, but the reason it's presented that way is because a tragedy teaches us what not to do. Mm. We don't want to end up like Hamlet. Hamlet made a mistake. He killed an innocent man. He killed Polonius. Mm. We don't want to end up like Othello. Othello killed his wife. So what it does is it shows us what not to do. So we won't make the same mistakes that Hamlet makes and Othello makes and Macbeth makes, and we can learn from that without having to kill anybody or suffer for it.
Yeah, well, and
not to mention a lot of those themes or issues exist in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or the writings of Dante. You know, classic literature is full of risque things, but it's not salacious. It's not titillating. It's ingrained in the art.
Mm-hmm. Well, and
exactly.
You know,
yeah, I would say that there's probably nothing more lewd in Shakespeare than would be defined in the Bible, really.
No, and that's absolutely true. Well, not only that, though, too, but, you know, and you brought up, and of course, we're working with Hamlet and so on, and we talk about Ophelia and, you know, her descent to madness, of course, is brought on by the fact that she lost her virginity before mm-hmm. marriage and then, you know, spiraled out. Her grief for her father led to her ultimate destruction, her suicide, throwing herself into the river. You know, these are showing not just the actions, not just the maiden having her maidenhood be taken, but the consequences of that in real life that can be sometimes quite tragic, you know, and balanced against some of those love sonnets where where the acts are pleasurable and lead to joy and all this, but you have this justice and this consequences, and I think that's an important lesson for children to learn as well.
I could agree with you more. Absolutely, absolutely right. And it's you know, a cause and effect. It's actions have consequences, and that I think that is probably the key lesson, if you will, that you know we need to present to young people and present to everybody. It's you know, actions have consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the interesting things about Hamlet is a play about. It's a very introspective play, and it's literally as the cover and commentary in the textbook. It's a story about processing thoughts and how the human mind goes from, you know, a thought to acting on that thought or not acting on that thought. And that's, I think, you know, something key. You know, you can think whatever you think, but when you act on that or when you decide to act on that, that's something different. And actions have consequences.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to your point, actions absolutely have consequences.
As does inaction, and that's also shown with Hamlet's pensive, moody display in the early chapters, leading to inaction, which provided this scenario. Absolutely. It's so easy for me to go into the richness and the depth of Shakespeare himself, and it is important for our educational process. Where do you see things going with First Folio Productions? I'm going to take us just a step back. So we've got, you know, Hamlet's in there, Hamlet's in line, and it's very well done. And I know that you've got a couple things more in queue. What do you see as being an end goal? I know we've got Othello on tap. Do you see completing the entire canon and making this all available through this same format?
Completing the entire canon would certainly be an ambitious goal, and it's certainly within the realm of maybe a 15-year plan or so, but I think the focus now is to cover the plays that are most frequently taught in high schools, which are Hamlet, Romeo and Juliet, Othello, Macbeth, Julius Caesar,
okay.
Midsummer Night's Dream. So that's where we would start. And in addition to that, it would be because the beauty of having a web application instead of a printed textbook is updates. You can update things, you know, all the time, as opposed to, like, you know, with a printed textbook, you got to go, and if you want to update something, you have to do another press run, and that costs a lot of money. But with digital technology, updates, depending on the nature of the update, updates can be done, in some cases, instantaneously,
mm-hmm.
and certainly very cost-effectively. So we're going to be developing these apps, and we're going to continually update them with audio content and with video content.
Now, you mentioned the audio content. This is good because I wanted to hit on this as well. So part of what you've done is, and we were talking about Ophelia, so this is perfect timing as well, is that you engage someone. I hadn't heard of her before. She's got a beautiful voice, Sarah Tunes, and you had her sing a rendition of Ophelia's Valentine's Day song in a very modern format, but you know, you're leaving the true text, but then you've got this music, which is, you know, clearly not set in the time frame. What made that decision? How did you get to that point with the music going popular?
Well, with the music, and in the same breath, I'm also going to talk about the video as well. It's, you know, one of the things, when people read a Shakespeare play, one of the things that is, they're not, if it's off-putting, or if a student feels that Shakespeare sounds old, it's not maybe possibly the language they're responding to. It's the context of the customs and habits of Shakespeare's time. Let's take Hamlet, for example. Hamlet is a play, and we covered this in commentary in the textbook. And by the way, your listeners can certainly visit the website, Hamlet2014.com, and get all sorts of, you know, additional information and download the app from Hamlet2014.com. But what we do is the customs and habits of Shakespeare's time are not necessarily applicable today, so they seem foreign and strange to us. For example, Hamlet's big dilemma is not so much that he has to murder his uncle, it's the fact that he has to kill a king. Hmm. And as the son of a king, if he kills Claudius successfully, he gets to be the new king. If he tries and fails, he's executed for high treason. It's that simple. The stakes are that clear, and they're that high. And everybody in Shakespeare's audience, you know, in 1601, when this play was first performed, would have understood that. But that's not a world we live in today. So what we're doing is taking the characters, taking the language, taking the story, and putting them in a modern backdrop. We have in development actually, we're in post-production of a full movie version of Hamlet that's set in modern-day New York. And it's that same spirit in which we did Valentine's Day. Valentine's Day is an important song because through music, Shakespeare quite brilliantly uses music to reveal character and advance the plot.
Mm. But the
music of that time might not sound necessarily appeasing to, you know, 16, 17-year-old ears.
Yeah.
But certainly Sarah Toon's is more aligned with today's musical taste.
Yep.
So it's the idea of combining Shakespeare's great work with the tastes and the customs and habits of today.
I see. And that makes sense because, of course, the music that was used at the time, much of the melody would have been familiar to the people at the time as well. Now, bringing Hamlet into modern day, and of course, you know, any of the Shakespearean plays have been translated and converted and reimagined and re-envisioned in so many different ways, and so many different times. My personal favorite modern telling of Hamlet is actually the Ethan Hawke, Kyle MacLachlan Hamlet that was done in 2000. And it sounds a little bit similar in that it was set in New York, but it was the scion of a large multinational corporation was how everything worked through with Hamlet. How is your version going to be different? What is going to set it apart from some of these other ones that have been done, and some that have been done very well, and some that have been, you know, not so great? What do you think is going to be the differentiator for it?
What's really sort of resonating is based on feedback we have so far, and we're not finished yet, we're actually in post-production right now, is the fact that Hamlet is the son of a South American drug cartel kingpin. So we get to call Hamlet not the son of a king, but the son of a kingpin.
Hmm.
So he comes to New York City to go to college because he wants to escape the violence of the drug trade. And he thinks he succeeded, and he starts dating the Polonius is the president of the college, and he starts dating Ophelia, his daughter. But then all of a sudden, his father dies, his uncle takes over as new kingpin, he marries his mother, and then they come, and his uncle and his mother descend upon him in New York to take him back to South America to basically run the cartel, which is exactly what he doesn't want to do. And there you have the whole sort of setup for a conflict that is, you know, more aligned with what, you know, you know, people in both, you know, North and South America and really all over the world are faced with today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I will definitely be in the line to make sure I get a look at that, I'm already picturing in my head, you know, of course, some modern version of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern looking very creepy and taking him back supposedly to run things, but of course with the secret message that he needs to be taken out and how he deals with that. So no, very, very cool, very cool stuff. You know, I should mention, I've got Dave and I've got Jay on. Dave chimed in at one point. I don't know. Is there stuff that I'm missing, guys? Jay, Dave, things that you wanted to chime in with that I didn't cover here. Please, let's throw it out.
This is a very exciting project, I think. And Also, I think it's about time. It's way overdue that textbooks, school textbooks, went digital. It's incomprehensible to me that it's taken this long.
Hello, Jay. Hello, Jay. How are you guys?
Mm-hmm. I'm in awe, actually, is how I am right now. I guess my question being, my guy that actually studied Shakespeare in London as part of his long-lamented English degree is, one, what's folio set is considered canonical for you, and are there any plans for the app to do sort of, you know, folio versioning, like toggle between Riverside and Oxford, or, you know, there's different cuts of the of Hamlet in particular. It's a very long play, and so there's sort of very famous cuts of it, you know, what scenes are often taken out, or that sort of thing, you know. Or if you do Macbeth, like, here's how Orson Welles did Voodoo Macbeth when he famously did that in New York, and here's the scenes he cut and how he arranged them. Is there any thought of doing that?
Well, thank you for that question. That's an excellent question. I'm really glad you asked it. So from a textbook perspective, what the digital textbook of Hamlet does is we match the first folio, which is the first, you know, obviously this is the 1623 first edition, first folio. What we do also include content from the Good Quarto, because one of the things that makes Hamlet such a long play is there were four versions of it published in Shakespeare's lifetime, and then we have the first folio. So, and what you find is that there's a lot of, I mean, entire passages and a lot of lines that were in the Good Quarto but not in the first folio, and vice versa. So, Hamlet, you know, we talk about, like, in movies today, in certain presentations, we cut certain things. Well, in Shakespeare's time, the Hamlet in its totality was probably never performed in Shakespeare's time in all of that completeness, because Shakespeare was constantly revising and editing all of his plays, and in particular Hamlet. So to answer your question, what we do is we primarily focus on the first folio, but with, you know, inclusion of the Good Quarto sections that are not in the first folio, and we also match the capitalization and punctuation that was used in the first folio, which is something that is in modern editions of Shakespeare's plays is I think too often missed, because the capitalization were cues to the actors to emphasize a certain word.
Which is, it's one of my favorite things with Shakespeare, is actually from Romeo and Juliet. You know, it's so commonly misunderstood, the wherefore art thou Romeo. She's not asking where is my Romeo, but why is this guy a Romeo? I love him so, why does he have to be part of the Montague clan? And it's that type of connectivity that needs to happen with Shakespeare to make it understood and make it relevant for people today. I'm sorry, Nick, I'm gonna have to pull this to a close. I can see Rob, the guy on deck for our next show here, for Rob Schott First, waiting out there, excited to get on board with us. There is so much more we could go in depth on here. I wish we had another half hour or an hour to go with. Where can people get more information about the First Folio Productions, the work that you're doing, whether it be for teachers, for students, for just for interested parties? Where would you suggest they get more information?
There's a lot of really everything is on our website, Hamlet2014.com. Hamlet2014.com, and really just go to that website, and you'll pretty much find all your questions, or most of your questions, hopefully, will be answered, as well as a download available for the textbook itself. You can also keep up to date on that website, Hamlet2014.com, of all the exciting things we're doing and are in development as far as, you know, film and audio and video content and future textbooks as well.
Very, very cool. And it is really neat stuff. And as mentioned, if we didn't mention it strongly enough earlier, not only is it a great introduction and a great analysis and a set for learning and understanding Shakespeare and Shakespeare's works, but also too, it's compatible with every device. It's web developed, so you can use it with your iPad, you can use it with your laptop, you can use it on your Linux box running Firefox or whatever you want to. It's not going to matter. So don't be shy. If you've got one of those old BlackBerry tablets or something, you'll still be able to get in there and play with it. And then I'm sorry, guys, I've got to rudely close this out. I'm so bad at bringing things to a close. You know what I'm going to do though, Nick? If it's okay with you, I am going to do. I always do a song at the end of the show. I'm going to play us. I'm going to lead us out with Sarah Toon's version of Valentine's Day. If that's a thumbs up from you for playing that on air.
A very enthusiastic thumbs up. Go for it.
Oh, fantastic.
Thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
It was an honor. Thank you so much. And keep up the good work. I'm sure you and I will talk again soon. Dave and Jay, thank you so much. I apologize. I didn't give you enough opportunity to jump in. I was so excited myself about it. We'll be talking to you guys next week as well.
All right. See you next time.
Take care, all. Bye.
Take care. Bye.
Wow, Nick Brouse, Dave Sinaki, Jay Garman, jgarman.net. You can also go to, of course, hamlet2014.com, and always check us out at facebook.com/techtalkwrlr or send us an email, techtalk@wrlr.fm. I've got to run. I'm running way out of time. Again, I'm leaving us here with Sarah Tunes, her version of Ophelia's Valentine's Day from Shakespeare's Hamlet. I think you're going to like it. Stay tuned. Don't go away, though. We've got Rob Shot first walking in the door as I speak, and you're going to want to catch up with him. He's got some great science, geek, fun, wonderful stuff to share with you. Thanks again for listening. You have been hearing Tech Talk on WRLR 98.3 LPFM in Round Lake Heights, Illinois.
If they come to me, by God, they are to blame.